Carol and I have really, and I say this sincerely and honestly, really been looking forward to this week. And I suppose it's partly that way because we spent so many years of our lives back in the Midwest. We love Colorado. This is a fantastic place to live, and we've been living here now for about 15 years after 14 years in the Chicago area. We look back on our 14 years in Chicago as our missionary experience, especially having been here now for all these years. But Carol is a native Michigander. She was born in a little town called Three Rivers, Michigan, or Triple Cricks, as we used to call it. And I came from Illinois. I don't know. Anybody here from Illinois? I know this is Hey, terrific. Where from?
Chicago, the missionary town.
The missionary town. Great. Well, you know what I mean. Yeah. And Peoria was my hometown. I was born in a little town downriver from there called Rushville, Illinois. Anybody know where Rushville, Illinois is? And good, yeah. And so we're just delighted to be here with you, and we feel a heart tie with you because of all the years that we spent back there in the Midwest. And we feel many, many, we've got still many, many roots back there. You know, I'd like to, just for a moment, underline and underscore a couple of things that Skip shared with us last night in the opening meeting. Because as Carol and I travel around and speak to couples, groups, on this subject of marriage, we discover some things that are pretty universal. One of them is marriage. Marriage is universal. I don't know whether you've ever stopped to think about that or not, but we've had the privilege of visiting many of the countries of the world and speaking on the subject of marriage. And everywhere we go, we find married couples. And I think that says something to us about this issue of marriage. And one of the things that we discover is that most of the issues that we face, the problems we encounter, the difficulties we face in our relationship as husband and wife are also universal. They are seemingly cross-cultural. It doesn't make any difference where we go. We seem to all have problems with communication. We seem to all have problems with money. We have problems with differences between us just because we're two people. And those things are universal. But another thing that we've discovered as we've traveled around that is a pretty universal factor, and that is most of us, after we have been married for 3 or 4 or maybe 5 years, we have begun to drift in our relationship with one another as a husband and a wife. We have lost sight of our goals. We're not sure where we're headed. We're sort of just getting up every morning and eating breakfast and going to work to make some money in order to be able to pay the house payment or the rent in order to have a place to sleep that night to get the rest we need in order to get up the next morning to have breakfast and go to work and make some more money in order to pay the bills and have a telephone to use and some food on the table and a house to sleep in that night in order to get some more rest to get up the next morning and have breakfast and go to work. And on we go, day after day, week in, week out, month in, month out. Not really stopping to think about where we're headed, what we're trying to accomplish as a married couple. I'm not much of a poet, but I came across a little bit of free verse recently that sort of describes this phenomenon. And, you know, I don't know where you are, but from time to time, Carol and I have to stop and take count of where we are. We have to do a little inventory. Every year, Carol and I spend 2 weeks up at Vail. And if you've never been up at Vail, Colorado in the summertime, you've missed one of the major treats of life. It's a beautiful little mountain town. And we go up there for 2 weeks. And one of the things that we do is take a little inventory of the previous year and where we're headed the next year. and what we want to accomplish and what we would like to see God do through our lives. But this little bit of free verse that I came across some time ago so much describes many, many people in our world today, both Christians and non-Christians, in their approach to life. And here's what it says. We go and keep going until the object of the game seems to be to go and keep going. We do and keep doing until we do without knowing, without feeling. Is there no time to stop and reflect? Is there no time to stop? Is there no time? If we stopped, would we keep going? If we reflected, would we keep doing what we do? For what we have done and where we have gone is dissolved into oblivion or strung on the meaningless chain of half-remembered this and that, if there is no reflection. In all our doing, have we done anything? In all our going, have we been anywhere? Very thought-provoking, huh? And I'm sure that there are some of us here this morning that kind of hits pretty close to home, because it's been a long time since we stopped and reflected and really take an inventory of where we're at, not only in our lives, but in our marriage. We've begun to drift. And you know when you start drifting, which way you're going. It's not upstream. It's downstream. You're going downhill. And the tragic thing about it is it's so subtle. Drifting is so subtle. It's so slow that we don't notice on a daily basis until we stop and we begin to reflect and we look back over the last year or two and we see where have we come in the last year or two. Well, our hope and our goal for this week is that you will take the time to do that. Now, I know many of you have got kids here, and that's going to consume a lot of your time, but I hope you will take advantage of this beautiful setting and this time that you have away from most of the normal things that interfere with your daily life. You don't have to go to work in the morning. You're just going to attend some meetings and then spend a little time with the kids. But I hope that you as a couple will figure out how you can get some time together this week to do a little reflecting, to take some inventory, to begin to commit yourselves to working on some areas of your relationship between yourself as a husband and a wife and between you as an individual and your God. That by the time you head out of these gates next Saturday morning, is it? Yeah. You've got some concrete things nailed down that you as an individual and you as a couple have committed yourselves to begin to work on. That is going to make a difference in the next few weeks and months and, yeah, even the years ahead. So I hope you've come with an openness of attitude and heart to, you know, to one another and to the Lord, as Skip was talking about last night. Well, before end of sermon right now, but before we go any further, I want you to get to know Carol and me a little bit more. We put together a little dialogue here so you could get to know us. This is kind of new, so you'll forgive us if we read it.
No, we're not.
But I want you to meet Carol. This is my lovely bride of some 38 years. And we will celebrate our 39th wedding anniversary come September the 3rd this year. And since we started, excuse me just a minute, this is not in the script, but since we've started going up to Vail those first 2 weeks in September, we're always up there on our anniversary, and we've got a favorite little restaurant that we go to in Vail called the Left Bank, and it's just a delightful way to celebrate our anniversary. But in reality, we celebrate our anniversary all year long. Whenever we're doing something special, why we click glasses and say happy anniversary, you know. So this is Carol, 38 years married to me, which is a miracle. And the mother of our one daughter, Lynn.
And this is my husband, Jack. He is the grandfather of our two grandchildren, Eric, 10, and Sonia Marie, 7.
Right, yeah. Lynn and her husband, Tim Westberg, are ministering with the Navigators in Guanajuato, Mexico. Oh, yeah, that's Jay. We met at Wheaton College and fell in love and became engaged.
And then unengaged.
And then engaged again.
And then unengaged again.
Finally, the third time, we made it to the altar, much to the surprise of many of our friends. And along with the ups and downs and the realities of the dailies, have been growing in our love ever since.
I want you to know that Jack is special. He's my encourager. He's my companion. He's my lover.
Well, this gal is pretty special, too. She's a real helpmeet to me, and she's just a lot of fun to be with. Over the years, we've discovered a great many ways in which we are alike. But we've also discovered many ways in which we are different. For instance, I'm nearsighted.
And I'm farsighted.
Now, that may not sound like a big deal until you're standing in church on Sunday morning trying to sing out of the same hymn book. We have since both gotten bifocals, and that has helped immensely.
I love romantic candlelight dinners.
Well, that's okay, but you got to see what you're eating. I shop by using Consumer's Report, the Yellow Pages, and the telephone.
But I want to see and touch and smell and compare everything before I buy. I like to explore old castles.
You've seen one castle, you know, you've seen them all. I like my shirts hung in a closet on hangers to the left with the shirts facing to the right.
Can you believe that?
I don't care for fish, no matter how you try to disguise it.
And I like fish fixed any old way, but I don't like peanut butter.
Can you believe that? My purpose on a driving trip is to get there.
But I like to see everything and do as many things as possible on the way. So I'll say, let's stop and ride the dune buggies.
And I'll say, let's stop and watch. Next time we'll ride the dune buggies. I say, if you haven't played a full 18 holes, you haven't really played golf.
Hey, it's just a game.
I say, honey, let's skip the wedding reception.
And I say, well, maybe 2 hours will do it.
I like the bottom line to be stated up front.
Who needs a bottom line? I like bumpy rides, little planes, and roller coasters.
Yeah, I know. When I'm sick, I like lots of tender, loving care.
And when I'm sick, I want to pull the shades and be left totally alone.
I like my steaks medium and my coffee black.
Me too.
I like my music soft and sweet.
Me too.
I like to get up early and start on the day.
Me too. Well, sometimes.
On a trip, I like to do the driving.
Honey, I love to have you.
I'm asleep when I hit the pillow.
And as I lay there trying to unwind, I'm so glad you don't snore.
When I'm nervous, I get quiet.
When I'm nervous, I start talking faster and faster.
Right. But you know, through both the ways in which we are alike and the differences, over the years, the thing that we have strived for and to a degree achieved, but it's a lifetime project, and that is that we have really become best friends. And so it's been a fantastic experience these 38 years to work on that and develop that between us in our relationship and to take these differences that exist between all of us and turn them from problems into possibilities. And that's a lifetime goal and a lifetime project to work on. Thanks, honey. There are two things that Carol and I feel are absolutely essential to the ongoing and development of a marriage relationship between a man and a woman, to make it rewarding, fulfilling, fun, to give it that spark that all of us want, but I'm afraid to say few of us achieve. The first thing that we feel is absolutely essential to this is that we've got to work at it. Now, neither of these things I'm going to talk about are cataclysmic. You know, they're not new to any of us. They're very simple, fundamental things, and yet they are very difficult to put into practice. And the first one is that we've got to work at our relationship. We, in this lifetime, with other human beings, can never develop a good working relationship that is meaningful and rewarding and fulfilling with another person unless we're willing to give it a priority in our lives, unless we're willing to work at it. Now, I'd like to give you two illustrations, one a negative and one a positive on that. The first one is from a gal by the name of Jessica Savage. Now, she's remaking the headlines these days. Two new books have just come out about her. But about 3 or 4 years ago, she wrote a book about herself called Anchor Woman. And if those of you who don't know who she was an anchor woman with ABC for many years and made a very great success in climbing the executive ladder with ABC and was one of the most admired women in the media at that time. So in 1982, she wrote this book called Anchor Woman, and in the early pages of it, she talks about her marriage, her first marriage. And from some of the statements that she makes, we can learn a great deal about this matter of the importance of working at our relationship. Let me read you just three paragraphs from one of those early pages in this book. On a January morning in 1980, I was married at the age of 31 to a Philadelphia advertising executive. After a traditional ceremony at the Plaza Hotel in New York, I went on a cross-country trip alone. Campaign 80 and my marriage began simultaneously. Some weeks, the only glimpse my husband caught of me was on television. John Chancellor once joked that in an election year, he kisses his wife goodbye just after Christmas and kisses her hello again after the inauguration. That may have worked for the Chancellors, but it sure didn't work for us. I followed candidates all day long, and while they rested, I kept working into the evening, writing and editing my stories to feed to the evening news or preparing for the next day's nonstop events. There was scarcely time to even phone home. My husband and I saw each other on an average of twice a month. And before the year ended, we made a mutual decision to not so much end our marriage as to not begin it. Now, that's what happened. Then in this last paragraph, she analyzes why it happened. And that's what we can learn something from. The separation was not strictly a casualty of my schedule. I had been naive enough to think I could build a lasting relationship out of mutual respect and friendship, to think I could create a storybook life without working at it. It had not occurred to me that marriage requires the same effort as a career. And unlike a career, a marriage requires a joint effort. It had not occurred to me that marriage requires the same effort as a career. And a joint effort is involved. Unfortunately, she discovered this too late. And of course, for those of you who are familiar with her life story, you know that just shortly after this book was published, in fact, the following year, 1983, she died in a very tragic automobile accident. And the new books that are coming out about her, I've not read either one of them, but I've read reviews of them, are picturing her life as a very great tragedy in many, many ways. But from my standpoint, as I view God's plan for us as married people, the greatest tragedy in her life was the fact that she couldn't make that work And you know, as I read through the scriptures and I get a picture of God's plan for us as married couples and his plan for marriage, I see that on his priority list, it's pretty high. He wants it to be successful. He wants us to be successful in our marriage. He wants us to really make it go. I don't think it is accidental that in Ephesians chapter 5, in that beautiful passage on marriage, verses 22 to 33, that the marriage relationship is the thing that is to exemplify Christ's relationship to his body. And that you see that all through that passage. And I don't believe that's an accident. I believe that God has put us together as married couples just the way we are and has worked it out in such a way that he wants us right where we are to exemplify that in our relationship with one another. And yet, many of us fall so far short. We all fall short. But are we working at it? And that takes commitment. In order for us to really be committed, I mean, to be willing to work at it, we've got to be committed. And a statement by Dr. David Hubbard, the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, brings that into focus for us. He speaks of marriage. He says, marriage does not demand perfection, but it must be given priority. I mean, that's a pretty simple statement. It doesn't demand perfection. And it's a good thing because we'll never achieve that as human beings. But it must be given priority. It is an institution for sinners. No one else need apply. Good deal, huh? That includes all of us. No one else need apply. But it finds its fullest glory when sinners see it as God's way of leading us to his ultimate curriculum of love and righteousness. His ultimate curriculum of love and righteousness. We got to give it priority, and then he kind of couches it in classroom terms. Leave it to the president of a theological seminary to do that, huh? But in a way, he's got a point. There's a sense in which married life together is school. We're in the classroom every day. There's a verse over in Proverbs 27:17 that talks about this. It says, iron sharpens iron, and one person sharpens another. Now you apply that to marriage, huh? So you take two pieces of metal and you begin to rub them together. What happens? Well, things come to your mind. Heat develops, huh? That's one thing that develops. That ever happened to you in your marriage relationship? A little heat develop? Sure. All of us have that. Sparks can fly when you rub two pieces of metal together. You get two lives rubbing together every day. There's going to be sparks fly. But another one of the positive things that happens, and those two are not necessarily negative, heat and sparks. We can learn from heat and sparks if we're open and willing to change. But another thing that happens is when you rub two pieces of metal together in the right way and at the right angle, they sharpen each other. And I believe that's what this verse in Proverbs is talking about. Iron sharpens iron, and one person sharpens another. And I hope we're letting that happen as we go through life as a married couple. I hope that we are learning from one another because we're working at it. Now, the second thing that is absolutely essential in the ongoing and development of a meaningful, warm, fun, intimate relationship as a husband and a wife is giving God his rightful place in our lives. Developing an intimate, warm, daily relationship with God. Now, why do I say that? Why is that one of two things? Well, I think the primary reason is because God invented marriage. I mentioned that it was universal, and I think that's one of the reasons that it is universal, is because God dreamed this thing up that we call marriage. It was his idea in the first place. It isn't something that we dreamed up as men and finally realized, you know, at one point in time that it was a good idea for a man and a woman to get hitched up and go through life together because they could complement one another. It wasn't our idea. It was his. He's the one who invented marriage. And because he has invented marriage, he needs to have a place in our relationship. Marriage is a triangle. You've got God up here, you've got the husband here, and the wife here. Communication needs to be developed between this husband and his God, and between this wife and her God. Now, it's very possible that in a group of this size that there's a handful here that may not have a relationship yet with God established through Jesus Christ. That's very possible. And if that's true with you, and of course you know that if it is true, that's where you need to begin. You need to get out here on one of these hills by yourself and talk that over with God. You need to develop a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. We read over in John chapter 3, Skip talked from John last night. The Lord Jesus Christ is speaking and he says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." And see, that's where we all have to begin. There's no exceptions to that. That's where we all have to begin, is to have a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ by inviting him to come into our life and be our Savior. That's why he came into the world. And so that's very essential. And if that's a little bit of a puzzle to you, then what you need to do is get aside with one of your friends that are here and talk to that person about this. They can maybe explain this a little fuller than my taking the time to do it any more than this morning. But that's where we all got to start. And then we need, once we've established a relationship with God, then we need to continue to develop that on a daily basis. Spending time alone with him every day in his word and in prayer. And during the course of this week, you're going to have opportunity to be in workshops where that aspect of your relationship with God will teach you how to develop it. Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24 says, "Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glory in this, that he knows and understands me, God, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the world. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord." He wants us to develop a relationship with him that has understanding. He wants us to get to know and understand him in a very significant way. Now, let me go back for just a second to this matter of God inventing marriage. We find that in Genesis chapter 2. And if you've got your Bibles, I would like to have you turn for just a minute to Genesis chapter 2, because it is such a fascinating story that we start reading our Bible January 1, and we start with Genesis chapter 1, and then we get to 2, and by that time we're already behind. And so we've got to hurry, and by the time we get to the last half of Genesis 2, we're going a mile a minute, like Skip was talking about last night, beeping our horn at people. And we overlook the some of the goodies that are here for us. But this is God's account of how marriage got started. And what I'd like to do is give you a little assignment as a couple this week. Sometime this week, what I'd like to have you do, when you got 10 or 15 minutes, the two of you get alone, out on a bench or a rock somewhere or somewhere, or out on the grass. Take your Bible along and turn to Genesis chapter 2, and beginning with verse 15, read alternately the verses in Genesis chapter 2, 15 on, out loud to one another. And then I want you to put on your most creative, imaginative hat that you can. Not a literal hat, but pull up all of that creative, imaginative power that you have. And pretend, you men, pretend that you are Adam. And you gals pretend that you are Eve. How would you have felt? What would the emotions have been as you read this together? And talk about that. If you had been Adam, what would have been going through your mind? If you had been Adam, what would the Garden of Eden be like? Did you ever stop to think about the fact that God created the Garden of Eden before he created Adam? But then he put Adam in the Garden of Eden. But he knew what Adam was going to be like. He knew what kind of aesthetic values Adam would have, what he would like, what he would not like. And so he created the Garden of Eden to fit Adam. You ever thought about that? Okay, you're Adam. What would your Garden of Eden be like? I mean, you're probably different than Adam was. You know, just to give you a little example, if I was Adam and it was my Garden of Eden, it would have to contain at least two beautiful, rather difficult but not too difficult, 18-hole golf courses. I love to play golf. But I don't enjoy golf just to play golf anymore. I like to play golf on kind of a neat golf course, a tough one, but not too tough. Not a Jack Nicklaus course. I mean, he makes them too tough. But see, you get the point. What would the Garden of Eden be like for you? Maybe some of you are fishermen. You know, well, what would it have? So put on your imaginative caps and then read all the way through this passage. Now, Eve, you don't have much of a part in this until right at the end. But boy, that part is very significant. So what would you have felt like when you finally realized you were in existence? There you are. And you see this guy laying there on the ground asleep. Yeah, that's probably what happened, you know. But then he begins to wake up. And he spots you. Okay, Adam, what went through your mind when you first spotted her? And then, right at the end, God performs a marriage ceremony. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. That statement is only mentioned four times throughout the Bible. Once here, once in Ephesians 5, and twice in the Gospels. But it's a very significant passage. Now, you know, there was a wedding ceremony of some kind that took place. I have no idea what it was like. Obviously, there weren't any bridesmaids or groomsmen, no organ music, no church or anything like that. But God pronounced them husband and wife, and we know that because as you go on to read in chapter 3, from that point on, Adam is referred to as the husband and Eve is referred to as the wife. So this was God's idea. It was his invention. But in order for you to really get the feel of that and be convinced of it, and I would like for you to get convinced of that because it can make a big difference in your life in this matter of your own relationship to God. If you're convinced that He really invented marriage and you got problems, then who are you going to go to? See, He's got answers. If he invented marriage, he's got some things to say to you and to me about how to develop a good relationship with your wife or with your husband that can take us a long way down the road without even having to go to a marriage counselor. Or some difficulties that you're facing between the two of you that you both go to his word and see and pray, Lord, help us to find an answer to this. See, God invented this thing. And folks, I know that if we're convinced of that, that it's going to make a difference in how we run our marriage. We're going to give God His rightful place in it. And I'm sure that there are a number of us here this morning that the last several months we've just been drifting in our relationship. We haven't given God a place in our marriage. Oh, maybe we've been having a quiet time once in a while, or we've memorized a few verses of Scripture, but we haven't really given Him a chance to get involved in our relationship as husband and wife, and to see what He may have to say to us. Now, it's not only important, as it points out in Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24, which I've already quoted to you, that we get to know and understand God. But it's also important that we get to know and understand one another. And some of you are sitting there and you're saying, well, what's new about that? Nothing. But the fact of the matter is that we really don't know each other very well. Most married couples, we've discovered, while they may think they do, they really have not explored all of the depths of the possibilities of really understanding that person to whom they're married. Carol and I have been married, as I mentioned, for 38 years, going on 39. And we are still discovering new things about each other that are different. And one of the things that we've discovered over the years about this matter of differences is, even though we are alike in numerous ways, it is not the ways in which we are alike that cause the problems between us. It's the ways in which we are different that down through the years has caused the problems. Now, we're going to be talking about this morning and a little bit tomorrow morning from this point on. And I want to emphasize one thing, and that is that we are not talking about man-woman differences. We are talking about people differences. Simply because you are two different people, you are probably different in numerous ways, even as we have discovered. Now, and from time to time, this rears its ugly head. And one of these differences pops up, creates a conflict. We have to work our way through the conflict. We finally get it resolved, put our head on the pillow at night, say goodnight, sweetheart. And there's harmony between us, and we're thinking, boy, man, I'm glad that's over. And we go on our merry way, and a few weeks go by, and the same thing crops up again, and a few weeks later, the same thing. And rather than those differences working for us, they're working against us. When in reality, what God wants is for these differences to work for us rather than against us. I mean, that's what He really wants. It was only four years ago, Carol and I were in Scotland, England, the northern part of Great Britain. And we had been ministering there for a little over a week in Glasgow with a number of couples. We'd been in their homes, talking to them, interacting with them, getting to know them. Had a fantastic time. And then the last weekend we were there, we were with a group of about 40 couples over on the west coast of Scotland at a little conference grounds over there, and had a delightful time. And then after that was over, we were going to take a week's vacation in Scotland and play golf and really do Scotland. And we had obviously played golf, St. Andrews included. And we had rented a car. It was a station wagon type of thing. They call it an estate car over there. It's billed a little high. An estate car sounds kind of classy, but it really wasn't. It was just an ordinary run-of-the-mill station wagon. So Sunday afternoon, after all the festivities were over, we loaded our golf clubs and the most important thing, and then our suitcases in the back of the station wagon, and off we headed. And we got to where we were going to stay that night, little hotel, and I went around to open up the back of the car and couldn't get the back door open. I tugged, I tried, I pulled, I got my feet up on the bumper and pulled, and it wouldn't come open. And so I found myself going in the back door, over the back seat, and pulling our suitcases out from underneath the golf clubs and taking them into the hotel. And then the next morning, the same thing in reverse all over again. And then that afternoon, we did stop and play some golf, and I had to get the golf clubs out that same way. I mean, it was really a mess. Well, 2 days of that was enough, and so the third morning we were checking out of the little place we were staying. I asked the guy behind the desk if there was a garage in town where I might possibly get this door fixed, and he told me where to go, and we went down there. I talked to the mechanic, and he said, sure, I can fix it. I said, how long will it take? He says, oh, probably half an hour. So across the street from this little garage was a beautiful old abbey, a church, and I knew that Carol would enjoy seeing something like that, so I suggested, honey, why don't you go across the street and see the church, and we'll get this car fixed and come on back in about a half an hour, and we'll be on our way. So she did. The guy got the car fixed, and after I could get the door open, man, I was in my glory now. I could straighten this mess out. And so as Carol came back across the street, and I was straightening out the luggage and the golf clubs and getting everything kind of reorganized, and she saw what I was doing, she said to me,
why don't you leave that till later?
Because I want to straighten it out now.
Well, don't get mad at me.
Well, you always argue with me.
Oh.
And she walked away. Now, that happened about 4 years ago. At that time, we had been married 35 years. You would think that we would have known better. We only said four sentences to each other. But in those four sentences, we violated three basic principles of interpersonal relationships. Now, folks, you've got to work hard to do that. I mean, three out of four. Well, we eventually got in the car. And as you can imagine, it was rather quiet for a few minutes. I don't imagine any more than 10 minutes had gone by. We were going on down the road, and Carol began to chuckle, and then a full laugh, and then I began to laugh. And we were laughing at ourselves for this dumb stunt that we had just pulled back there at the garage. And then we began to talk about it, and we probably talked for 20 minutes or so and kind of analyzed the situation and apologized to each other for getting uptight and went on our way and had a fantastic day. Now, if that same thing had happened to us 20 years prior, it would have ruined the whole day. And that was 9:30 in the morning. I mean, ruined the whole day. Primarily because of one element in all of us that we all have. Lousy, stinking human pride. See, our tendency is when something like that happens, is to say within ourselves, boy, she's wrong. She's going to have to apologize for that, boy. And so we just mentally dig in our heels and we wait. And we kind of act a little childish. We kind of stick out our lower lip. And the problem is the other person is thinking the same thing. And so you go all day long not speaking to one another. The day is ruined. All because of pride. We got to come further than that, folks, in our relationship. And fortunately, over those 20 years, Carol and I had learned a little bit, and so we resolved the whole thing in less than a half an hour and went on our way and had a merry time and really enjoyed the day. I mean, we only had 7 days, and when you ruin one, boy, I tell you, that you both feel badly about that later on. But let me tell you about the three things that happened, okay? What did we do wrong? Well, you remember the first words out of Carol's, the first word out of Carol's mouth when she came back across the street and saw what I was doing? Remember what she said? Why? Why are you doing that now? Now, how many of you enjoy being asked a why question like that under similar circumstances? Anybody enjoy that? Well, I think we're all in the same boat on that. We don't enjoy it. We don't like it. Why not? Well, It's not so much because of the why, but it's because of the why connected with the circumstances. You see, you're just pulling out of your drive and you got another person in the front seat, in the passenger side. And you head out and you make your first right turn, and then the person turns to you and they say, why are we going this way? Or it's Sunday morning and man, you know, you really feel great and you've done your best to put on just everything that matches and it's just right. And you come downstairs and your wife takes a look at you and she says, why are you wearing that tie with that coat? We don't like that, do we? You see, when somebody asks a why question like that under those kinds of circumstances, they are not really asking a question, are they? Even though it's why, it starts with why and ends with a question mark, it's still not really a question they're asking. They're really making a statement, aren't they? See, what was Carol really saying when she saw what I was doing and she says, why are you doing that now? What she was really saying is, if I had my way, we wouldn't be messing around with the golf clubs and the suitcases now. Or this person sitting next to you in the front seat. What they're really saying is, we sure wouldn't be going this way. Or what your wife is saying is, man, if I had my choice, you wouldn't be wearing that tie with that coat. See, so they're making a statement which challenges our good sensibilities. Huh? And so we become defensive. And that's exactly what I did. And it wasn't so much what I said as the tone of voice I used. Like Skip mentioned last night, we communicate an awful lot by the nonverbals. If I'd have said, well, sweetheart, I think, you know, I've been living with this mess for 2 days now, and this is a good opportunity to get these things straightened out. But I didn't. I said, because I want to straighten it out now. And then she says, well, don't get angry. Now, where did she get the idea I was angry? Man, we're so human, aren't we? So why questions? We need to be careful. And by the way, the number of why questions you ask your spouse can be a pretty good indicator or a barometer of your acceptance level of that person. And if you find yourself asking those kinds of why questions quite frequently, it may be that you need to take a little self-inventory and see if you're really accepting the other person in the way that you should. Because many, many times, those kinds of situations are not wrong, they are just different. The way to go someplace. The tie and the coat. Taking the time to straighten out the luggage. Most of the time, I'd say, it's not wrong, it's just different. And so why questions put the other person on the defensive, and it's an indication that in that particular issue, at that particular time, we're just not accepting of them. All right, that's the first thing. That's the first out of the three. Now, the second has to do with the last statement I made to Carol. Do you remember what I said to her? My last cute little remark? You always argue with me. Well, the fact of the matter is, that's not true. She doesn't always argue with me. She just argues with me once in a while. And that's perfectly okay. We all, as married couples, have arguments once in a while. And as long as we can work our way through it and get it resolved, fine. Or agree to disagree. That's another. I mean, we've got some things that we just agree to disagree on. But to accuse the other person of always doing something or never doing something is just not true. I mean, we're human beings. None of us are that consistent that we always do something or we never do something. And so the first thing is it's untrue, but secondly, it's an accusation that we just need to steer clear of because it's unkind. In fact, accusations of any kind are unkind most of the time, even though sometimes they may be true, speaking the truth in love. They've got to go in harmony, huh? Sometimes it's true, but it's not kind to say it, and vice versa. So we need to be careful about using superlatives with our mate in an accusatory way. Okay, that's number two. The third thing is the underlying basic thing that made the whole thing happen in the first place. And it isn't anything that we necessarily said. It was the way we are as two different human beings. You see, why was I taking the time then to straighten out the luggage and the golf clubs? Why was I doing that after living with this mess now for 2 days? Why was I doing that? Some of you know. Because you're wired together the same way I am. That's what you would be doing. It's because I'm a perfectionist. Huh? And man, I'd been living with this mess for 2 days. And now I had my chance to straighten it out, and I had the time to do it. And so that's what I just naturally gravitated toward. Now, the problem was that Carol is just the opposite of a perfectionist. By the way, someone described a perfectionist as a person who takes great pains and gives them to everybody else. And there are some of you in this crowd, I'll guarantee you. And, you know, being one myself, I feel sorry for those of you who have to live with one. You must have a great tolerance level at times. You see, the philosophy of a perfectionist is, if you don't have time to do it now, wait until you do have time to do it. Right. That's pretty well summarizes it, isn't it? The problem is that somebody who is just the opposite of a perfectionist that word wait kind of gets to them. And they don't look upon it as waiting until you've got the time to do it right. They look upon it as procrastination. They tag it with another name. Now, Carol is just the opposite of me in this area. And I don't know whether you've ever stopped to think about what is the opposite of a perfectionist. But I have. Carol, I would describe not as sloppy, but as fast. Carol is fast. And for the most part, as I've studied this thing, that's what I find to be sort of the opposite of a perfectionist. Because a perfectionist is slow. I mean, let's face it, folks. Those of us who are in that category, for the most part, we're slow. Now, I have run into a handful of people who are fast perfectionists. But boy, for the life of me, I can't figure them out. But anyway, Carol is fast. So, here's the situation. You got perfectionist Jack straightening out the luggage in the back of the car, and here is fast Carol coming back across the street. Now, what is on her mind? Huh? Let's get going, right. What are we waiting for? We got all of Scotland to conquer. Let's not mess around with the luggage and the golf clubs now. Let's go! And so, when she saw what I was doing, why are you doing that now? Now, the difficulty is that we knew that about each other. After 35 years of marriage, we discovered that years before. We'd been living with it. We'd been working with it and developing it and compensating and learning from one another. But in a split second of time, we just forgot. See, if I had really stopped to think for just 2 seconds, when Carol comes back, what's she going to want to do? Go. If Carol had stopped to think just for 2 seconds, when she saw what I was doing, why is he doing it? Okay, yeah, he's got to get that straightened out. You know, the whole thing would not have happened. So you see, the difference between us in this area is the thing that created the conflict to start with. It wasn't what we said. That was just the process of working out the conflict and developing it. into a beauty that we had to resolve after we climbed in the car. And you know, I'd say that 90% of the time that's the case. That's what starts a conflict in the first place, is a basic, fundamental, underlying difference between you and your spouse that many of you have failed to take into consideration and work your way through it to the point where it has become an asset in your relationship rather than a continual liability. Now, this is an asset to us. We've discovered that there are many ways that this perfectionist fast thing really works for us rather than against us. And we've talked about it and analyzed it and concluded some things that this is great. God's made us this way. Let's capitalize on it. I mean, you try and change a perfectionist. I mean, to any great degree. Now, over the years, Carol and I have changed. But see, it's the way we are. It's the way we're wired together. Not wrong, just different. See, when we first got married, I can't stretch my arms far enough to describe the difference between us in this area, how far apart we were, perfectionist Jack and fast Carol. But as the years have gone by and we have experienced this iron sharpening iron and one person sharpening another and rubbed together and had to live with the fallout of my being a perfectionist and Carol being fast and of learning from one another, we have grown closer together in this area. We have modified our position. We have mellowed, I think, in this particular area, and we've made great progress in 38 years. And I'd say now we're about right there rather than way out here. I have to admit that that's probably all the progress on this thing we're going to make in this lifetime. I mean, we've come about as far as we can probably on this one. Because there are just things that we've discovered that it's better that we don't do together because of this difference. For instance, we don't wash a car together. I don't know whether you can picture that or not, but you know, Carol has her bucket and sponge, and I have my bucket and sponge, and Carol has her side of the car, and I have my side of the car, and we say go, and so Carol goes zip, 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 and you know, she says I'm finished, and here Jack is still working on the front fender over here, and of course now it's inspection time, and so. I walk around to the other side of the car and I look at it over very carefully and, you know, give it a little white glove treatment. And I say some dumb thing like, you're finished. And, you know, I end up with a bucket over my head. So we don't wash cars together. We don't hang wallpaper together. I mean, I feel that the lines ought to be, you know, straight up and down. And to Carol, it really doesn't matter. So, you know, there are things we stay away from. Isn't married life fun? I got to tell you one humor story I heard. What time is coffee break? 10:30? Okay. Married life is full of spice, I think. It is so funny sometimes, some of the things that happen. I heard about this one married couple. I think it was a Saturday morning. They had gotten up. This is a true story. This really happened. They had gotten up, and before the day had even gotten started, before they were even dressed, they had had a little fight, a little misunderstanding, disagreement, and they kind of were ticked off at each other in a mild sort of way. And so she was getting dressed, and she asked him to help her with the zipper on the back of her dress. And he said, sure, I'll help you. And he went over, and he went, zip, 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 and walked away. And left it down. Well, she didn't know what to, I mean, she just stood there dumbfounded, not knowing what to do or say. Well, the day went on, and she was pulling in the drive that afternoon from shopping, and she was taking the groceries out of the back of the car and noticed that her husband was underneath the other car working on it in the driveway, and he was half out and half under the car. And, of course, the half that was under was from the waist up, and the half that was out from was from the waist down. And so she looked over that situation and saw an absolutely glorious opportunity. And so she walked over and reached down and took the zipper on his pants and went zip, zip, zip. And left them down and triumphantly walked on in the house. Well, she walked into the kitchen and there was her husband standing there. She said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "What do you mean, what am I doing here? I live here." "Well, who's that out under the car?" "Oh, that's Joe next door. He's helping me fix the car." So they go rushing out the front door to find out how Joe is. And they look under the car, and Joe is out cold. When she'd pulled this little zipper trick, he raised up, hit his head on the bottom of the car, and knocked himself out cold. Oh, wow. Now, that's married life, huh? That's married life. The funny thing is, that's not the end of the story. It's the end as far as the marriage thing is concerned and husband and wife, but this actually happened. And so they rushed in the house and called the ambulance or the paramedics. And so they came roaring out and they hauled Joe out from underneath the car and put him on a stretcher and were taking him toward the ambulance. And they wanted to know how all this happened. And so they started telling the two guys carrying Joe how this happened. And they started laughing so hard, they dropped Joe. Well, when Joe fell off, he hit on the concrete and broke his shoulder and ended up suing everybody. So be careful about asking your neighbor to help you with your car. That's, I guess, the moral of the story, huh? Oh, my. Oh, that is so funny. Well, listen, we want to give you a little assignment. So if you'll take the handouts that you have. You'll notice on the first page it puts all of us as couples into categories, 1, 2, or 3. And so let me just explain that to you. We realize that in a crowd of this size, there could be 3 different categories of why you're here or where you're at in your relationship with one another. Category 1 or both of you have been coerced into coming to the seminar or the conference here. There are numerous things you aren't talking about in your relationship, subjects that when discussed cause a quarrel. Now, it's possible there are some of you here like that. And, we have dealt with couples enough to realize that you can sit there and have a nice smile on your face, but down inside there's some real hurts. Category 2, you're both here because you want to be, but recognize deep needs in your marriage. One or both of you are hurting, but you're committed to working through the problems. And then category 3, you have a good thing going in your marriage. You can handle some conflict and want to work at making your marriage better. Now, the thing that we'd like to ask you to do between now and tomorrow morning is to get a little time together as a couple and decide which category you're in. Agree on it. Now, I realize it's quite possible that you will disagree on which category you're in, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, because you do have different perspectives, possibly, on your relationship. But let me give you this suggestion. If one of you thinks we're category 2, and the other thinks we're category 3, then when we give you the assignments, go with category 2 because it's the easier thing to do. It's the less explosive assignments that we will have. You understand what I mean? Or if one of you thinks you're 2 and one thinks you're 1, go with 1 assignments rather than 2. But between now and tomorrow morning, get a little time together And you decide which category you're in, because all week long we're going to give you little assignments out of these handouts. So bring them with you each session in the morning sessions, and we will work our way through some of these. Now, I want to give you a little one right now, just kind of a taste of what this can do. And you don't need to have decided on which category you're in at this point to do this, because on page 2, to understand each other, the first two statements that you need to write down some answers to are the same in each category. So what we'd like to have you do is right now, right where you're sitting, take a pen or a pencil, and under number 1, list ways in which both of you are alike. Think of 2 or 3 ways in which you are alike. And then number 2, list ways in which you are different from one another. List 2 or 3 ways in which you're different from each other. Just think about that for a minute and then write down your answers right now. Okay? What we'd like to have you do with that is sometime this afternoon, when you got 10 minutes, the two of you, in addition to deciding which category you are, share your answers with each other and kind of talk it through. One or both of you, it's quite possible, have written something down there that the other hadn't even thought about. So talk about it together and share your answers and take, at least 10 minutes sometime this afternoon and go for a walk or while you're watching the kids play or something. Just begin to share with each other. Now, before Carol comes up, and she's only going to have about 10 minutes, I want you to stand up, all face that way. Okay? Now, give the person in front of you a neck rub. Okay? All right, now turn around the other way and do the same thing. Okay, you may be seated. I'm really pulling a dirty trick on Carol. We've only got 10 minutes left, and I give it to her, and she's ready to talk her in between the two of us. I mean, see, that's one of the differences between us. I don't talk much.
Oh, no.
And she is, so have fun, honey.
Thanks. Let me just say, one of the things that we are praying for you this week is that you will fall more and more in love with Jesus. And secondly, that you'll fall more and more in love with one another. And learn how to take the differences that we're talking about to really complete each other and to become one, to become best friends. And just the one that Jack mentioned, the perfectionist fast, I have to give you the little flip side of that. Because one of the things that we have found that we so appreciate about that very difference is the fact that Jack rarely waits for me. I am usually ready before he is, and you know, the husband. So he appreciates the fact that when some husbands are continually waiting around for their wives to get ready, I'm there. And of course, I appreciate so much the fact that I rarely get involved in any kind of planning for trips and whatever. He is so good at it. He will have checked out every car rental agency on the face of the earth, I think, to find out the best price. And he gets all those wonderful things organized and in detail. So just on that one, we are grateful for one another. I'm going to have time just for a cartoon, really, and to get us started here. But one of my very favorite cartoonists is Charles Schulz, who writes Peanuts, as you know. And this one is just classic for what we want to begin this morning and continue tomorrow. Peppermint Patty is sitting under a tree and she's saying, "I'm not beautiful, Chuck. Do you think I'm not beautiful because I'm being punished for something I did in a former life?" And he says, I don't say anything, Chuck. I know I'm not beautiful. Don't say anything. Say something, Chuck." He says, "What? I mean, maybe it's wrong to complain about being beautiful, not being beautiful. Do you think it's wrong? Do you, Chuck?" I suppose I'm being kind of silly, you know. Do you think I'm being silly? Do you, Chuck?" Just about this time, Snoopy comes along and gives Peppermint Patty a great big smack on the cheek. And the last frame shows Peppermint Patty and Snoopy walking away, and she's saying, "I'm glad you came along, Snoopy. Talking with Chuck isn't very satisfying." And he just sighs. And as I read that, I thought, it's obvious that Charlie Brown doesn't understand girls. But then the fact is, most of us do not really understand one another. And there is so much to understand, isn't there? We have to understand each other's personality types, our backgrounds, our extrovert-introvert differences, our gifts, our talents, our idiosyncrasies. And to do that, because we are always changing, is really a lifelong project, a lifelong adventure. And it's one that should be challenging, should be exciting for us. But it's one that often we don't even think about doing. Really understanding is going to take a lifetime. And I wonder how many of you have prayed this week that you would understand your partner better this week. I think it should be a prayer that we should pray probably at least once or twice a week, that we would just understand the one that God gave us better and better and better. And of course, it takes God's help. He's the one that created that person. And he's the one, as we pray James 1:5, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, gives to all men liberally, and it shall be given him." Man, can we hang on to that. To know that God will give us that kind of understanding. And then I hope that you're praying every day that you just love each other more. Charlie Shedd has said, "True love has no maximum." I like that. There are always new vistas ahead in this area of love, that you can fall more deeply in love day by day. But God is the author of love, isn't he? Now, God gave us two eyes with which to see things from a slightly different point of view. If you only have one eye, you see things flat. You lose perspective, dimension. But when you have two eyes, you see things, as it were, in the round. I think that's a beautiful picture of marriage. God gave us two distinct personalities, so that as we come together and really grow to be one, we are going to be able to see life. We are going to be able to see God. We're going to be able to see people in the round, so to speak. And that's our goal. Proverbs 24:3-4 says, "By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. And by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches." We need God's wisdom. Now, the Bible defines marriage as the two becoming one flesh. And while we're going to get to the physical part of that, we feel that becoming one flesh means so much more than just physical. We feel that becoming one flesh means becoming one in vision, in heart, in goals, in unity, and above all, becoming, as we said before, best friends. But my friends, that does take work. It takes God's help to do that. And in order to do that, we've got to be aware, first of all, of the fact that we do need God's help. So often we come to marriage with unrealistic expectations, don't we? In fact, Jack and I were talking with a full-time marriage counselor not too long ago who does nothing but does premarital counseling. And when we ask him what was the problem that he ran into the most, without a moment's hesitation, he said, unrealistic expectations. And I think that's not only true of engaged people, but it's true with us as married couples. We come to marriage thinking that the other person is going to meet our needs, is going to fulfill us in areas that we don't feel complete in, and all of us do have needs. We all have areas in which we need to be completed. But, oh, my friends, I've seen wives destroy marriages because they made demands of their husbands that no human being can meet. And they kept demanding, and their husbands kept backing away until finally something was destroyed that could have been very wonderful if they had realized that the one who meets the needs of our heart is God. And so we come to marriage, or should, to be a complete person. And of course God's going to use our mates to meet some of those needs. Of course. Now, do I sound like I'm talking out of two sides of my mouth? Well, no, I'm not really. What we've got to know is that it is God that completes us, meets our needs. When He chooses to do it through our husband or through our wife, when He chooses to do it through our children or through friends, we desperately need them, and He won't do it in any other way. But when those people can't, or in some cases won't, God can and will. And we can come as whole people in God. So we desperately need to know that it is God and God alone who meets the needs of our hearts. That's the first thing we've got to know. And secondly, we've got to be a student of ourselves. And thirdly, we've got to be a student of that one that God gave to us. And with that, we're going to close because it's coffee break time. And we will come back to this subject of really knowing and completing one another and how to turn those problems into possibilities.